You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome back to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Dr. Melody Fox, and our co-host, Alan Cardoza, is out on location today doing what he does best, and we'll be back next week. As every week, we like to bring to you and our listeners guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound. With each of us having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we have both been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we continue today as we bring to you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our guest today is Dr. Paul E. Keck Jr., and he is the president and CEO of Linder Center of Hope. It's a premier mental health center in Cincinnati, Ohio, providing life-changing outcomes to individuals suffering with mental illness and addiction. Now, Dr. Keck is a researcher in bipolar disorder and psychopharmacology, and is also the author of over 500 scientific papers in leading medical journals, and was the seventh most cited scientist in the world, published in the fields of psychiatry and psychology over the past decade. Now, today's topic is called Failure to Launch, What's Really Holding Back Emerging Adults. Now, as parents and grandparents, siblings, and those are just thoughtful about the future, we recognize that one of the most vulnerable segments of the population is emerging adults, making the early transition into adulthood. And I know several people that come into the family that say that their child went off and launched, but now they're back into the nest. So Dr. Keck, welcome to Answers for the Family. I'm interested in talking to you about this whole subject and finding out everything you know about it.
Well, thank you, Dr. Fox. I'm delighted to join you today and look forward to our program.
Well, I think it's such an interesting subject. I mean, just, failure to launch. We're hearing more and more about that on the news. I'm hearing about it from parents coming in, for sessions, not knowing how to help their child. Can you describe a little bit more of what that is and what that means?
Well, we live in probably to state the obvious, an unbelievably complicated society these days. And, of course, there are many wonderful things about the society in which we live. But just compared to when I was growing up, the availability of the internet, email, 24-hour news cycles, career opportunities that are far more different than existed even 10 or 15 years ago, produce not just great opportunities, but a lot of challenges for young people. And I think almost all of us know someone between the ages of 18 and 34, and that's a relative age range. Failure to launch is a phrase that could be used to describe older people if early problems aren't adequately and accurately assessed and identified and then addressed. Problems that occur in our late teens and early 20s. Can unfortunately have long-term and pervasive consequences if we don't help people early on.
Now, so you talked about ages 18 to 34 and sometimes even later, and that's the emerging adult. Now, is that the failure to launch? Is that the same as somebody launching and coming back to the nest and not wanting to launch again?
Well, I think when we think about most of the basic things that all of us hope to accomplish early in life, finding a partner, finding a career or a vocation, and being able to be self-sufficient and live independently with a roof over our heads, I think those are the key challenges that traditionally have fallen into the age range of 22 to 24 years old. And of course, being emotionally mature, passing key developmental milestones like being independent, which we've known psychologically is a critical thing from late adolescence through early adulthood, are all part of those critical years. The pernicious thing about many psychiatric illnesses is that many of the most common psychiatric problems, depression, bipolar disorder, addictions, these illnesses often rear their heads for the first time during this same critical age span. So that if these psychiatric problems aren't addressed, or that people just aren't aware of the signs and symptoms of them, or the individual with them isn't able to access good quality treatment, those illnesses can in turn disrupt normal development and the achievement of these normal tasks in a very critical and profound way, such that people end up playing catch-up for many, many years, and in the worst-case scenario, for sometimes decades later.
Yeah, I was thinking about that when you were mentioning psychiatric issues and things and mental illness such as anxiety and depression. Sometimes you don't see it in their late teens and they go off to college and then they start experimenting or they get depressed or their anxiety goes up and then they end up back home.
That's exactly a common scenario, unfortunately.
Yeah. What are the statistics of, I guess, 18 to 29 year olds that might meet a criteria for psychiatric disorders that would, you know, interfere from them going off and being independent?
Yeah, the numbers are actually pretty staggering. In a given year, and these are from good epidemiologic studies, in other words, studies done in the general U.S. population, going door to door and assessing very carefully for the presence or absence of any kind of mental health problem. In a given year, it's been estimated that about 40% of U.S. 18 to 29-year-olds meet criteria for at least one significant psychiatric problem, and that's a higher rate, that 40%, much higher rate than for any other age group in our overall, you know, demographic of the U.S. And in terms of what kinds of disorders, the most common tend to be anxiety disorders, substance use, and mood disorders, which in and of themselves each comprise about 22% of that age range population. Now, you'll notice those numbers aren't really additive, and that's because these problems often co-occur. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty common to see someone struggling with, say, alcohol problems, but it turns out in a lot of situations that those alcohol problems started because someone wasn't sleeping and was anxious, and that those were really the harbingers of depression. And unless you are able to carefully sort out, you know, the alcohol problem and the depression and treat them both simultaneously, then people tend not to make the recovery that is otherwise quite possible and usually does happen with good treatment.
So I'm just wondering, what do you think is the cause of this rise or such a high percentage?
Well, it's the million-dollar question, and I don't think we precisely know. There's something that's been characterized as a cohort effect, and all that really means is that cohorts are age groups, and 35, 40 years ago, the peak age of onset of depression in the U.S. was actually in people in their 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. It wasn't in teenage years. And with each succeeding generation, the peak age of onset of depression has been moving closer and closer to now its current age range of 18 to 24. There's clearly a genetic risk that comes with many psychiatric illnesses. We all inherit some kind of genetic risk for some illness vulnerability, whether it's heart disease or diabetes. And some people carry a genetic risk for depression and similar problems. So it seems to be a genetic risk factor, but also clearly stresses and environmental things are triggers. The analogy I always like to use is, if you inherit a risk for high cholesterol, and you eat cheeseburgers every day, you're probably going to have a heart attack in your 30s. Whereas if you take care of your environment and eat in a healthy way, you still may have a heart attack, but you may have it 30, 40 years later. I think the same is true probably for many of the psychiatric illnesses that people struggle with. If people come from a healthy, nurturing family background, and if they are able to lead healthy lifestyles, avoid substance use problems, things like that, then the risk of a depression, for example, being triggered is substantially lower compared with risky behaviors and things like that that can unfortunately unmask these problems much earlier.
Well, you mentioned risky behavior and such, and I keep thinking, you know, there's a lot of people in the media, some young adults that, you know, engage in a lot of risky behavior and kind of role model that. Do you think that kind of normalizes that behavior for a lot of young adults, and that might contribute to them having a few setbacks on getting out on their own?
Well, I think there's a natural inclination for adolescents, especially early adolescents, as part of adolescent brain development to engage in risky behaviors. One of the curious things about human brain development is that although a lot of the intellectual apparatus that we need is fairly well mature pretty early on in life, the emotional regulation of our brains takes a while to happen, and boys typically lag behind girls in emotional development. Impulsivity, risk-taking behavior is fairly normative for most teenagers, and you know, one of the most difficult things about being a parent is knowing you know, how much, I'll say, normal deviance, and I don't mean juvenile delinquent type deviance, but you know, normal risk-taking behavior is just that, normal versus how much to clamp down and set guidelines and try to, you know, keep the path of your child on the relative straight and narrow with still the possibility that they learn from their mistakes. And we all learn from mistakes. But role models, quote unquote, that espouse those kinds of risky behaviors, I think we also often have to point out the downside of the allure of some of that celebrity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's so much reality TV and MTV and, you know, all the cable stations, and they kind of glorify some of that very high risk behavior sometimes.
Yeah. And I think I don't want to sound like or be a prude about it, but I think, you know, dose is everything. If some reality TV is probably fun, The Great Escape, but I think keeping it in perspective and keeping probably the fact that it's TV and not really reality is the important caveat to all of those influences.
Well, it's kind of hard when they call it a true life series, and you know, it's entertainment, people.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I was just curious about that because I know I used to go to a lot of group homes for girls, and they would have all these reality shows on, and they thought that was how they're supposed to act and react to their boyfriends, to their parents, to their siblings, to their peers, to, you know, whomever. And all that behavior kept them from becoming functional adults in that arena, not learning the good tools, because they really thought that that's how you're supposed to be when you're an adult.
Yeah, and maybe it's an interesting observation. I think maybe the opportunity is really in discussing as a family, you know, what is and isn't healthy, what isn't truly reflective of reality, and what's really for entertainment value on some of these shows. You know, unfortunately, during adolescence, the greatest source of influence on behavior is typically one's peers. And if you expand the peer set to reality TV that's in vogue at the time, that presents even a bigger challenge. I think the constantly bringing back and talking about things, communication is so much an important fundamental of of all human relationships, and obviously beginning with our own families, the more you can talk about things, not even necessarily in a judgmental way, but just talk about them. And you know, what is or isn't healthy behavior is probably the best way to frame it. I think can help put a lot of things that young people get exposed to, hopefully in the right perspective.
Sure. And, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, as a parent, what are the things that you want to look out for with your teen or young adult who seems to be a little bit behind the curve of even motivation of going out on their own and exploring the world, et cetera?
Yeah, I think this is where it is often difficult, but certainly not impossible to sort out what's you know, again, what's normal within the normal range of adolescent behavior versus what's a red flag. You know, adolescents sleep late. Adolescents usually have a sleep shift, so that especially adolescent boys, but the girls also to some extent need to have a sleep cycle in which they fall asleep later, but need to sleep in later. And of course, most school schedules don't quite fit that normal biological cycle. Changes in motivation and attention, especially with social distractions, are pretty common. Mm-hmm. But when you start to see what I call, and I think what the field would regard as kind of hard warning signs, it's not normal for any child or teenager or young adult, for that matter, to have suicidal thoughts. That's a warning sign. Mm-hmm. A persistent sleep disturbance, a sudden deterioration in academic performance. You know, a kid who goes from being an AB student to suddenly a CD student over a 6-week grading period. There's something going on there that, you know, usually requires some significant attention. And again, communication, I think, is key, not just with one's own child, but with the school as well, because often teachers, school counselors, they know the word on the street sometimes much ahead of when we as parents find out about things. When people start having any kind of behavior that's psychotic behavior is a harsh term, but when some psychotic illnesses do begin during adolescence, and right, when people have beliefs and ideas that just make no sense in reality, or there's evidence that they're hallucinating, those are obviously very, very serious warning signs. Mm-hmm. Same thing, obviously, with alcohol and drug use. If it's significant, persistent, impairing somebody in any way, it's time to have a talk and get some help. I think the biggest problem that most families face is just that we all have an internal denial. You know, nobody wants to admit there's a problem, especially, you know, with one's own child. We often, as parents, think, oh gosh, I did something wrong, or it's my fault, and so sometimes people let problems build and build and build, when if, you know, there was an earlier intervention, the problem may not have grown much at all, and, you know, the outcome might have been very, very different. Secondly, it's hard just for any of us to go seek health care. I mean, I don't look forward to going to see my internist once a year. It's not that I don't like him. It's just it's always anxiety provoking. Every time somebody goes to see a health professional, you don't really know what they're going to say. You don't really know, if you're going to be okay or not, or if there's a problem, what the recommendation is going to be. These are scary experiences, and I think when we get into the realm of mental health, there's so much, so many myths about it, so much caught up in stigma that mm-hmm. it makes it doubly harder for people to cross that threshold and reach out and get help. And then lastly, often people don't know where to turn for help.
Right.
And so those are the obstacles that get in people's way early on.
Well, what would you recommend if, say, a teacher was listening right now and she's noticed some of more bizarre behavior or some of these behaviors from their students? How would you best guide them to deal with that?
Well, I think we need to get over the idea that, that bringing up a difficult topic is a bad thing. I think as long as the spirit behind which an intervention, and I mean an intervention just in asking a question, hey, are you okay? Or hey, what's going on? Or hey, I noticed your grades are slipping. Or hey, I noticed you're not coming to class. Or you know, just asking open-ended questions. Sometimes just a well-meaning question or expression of concern is enough to break a logjam. And I, so just raising the issue, if on the other hand, you get resistance or no information at all, and if a teacher or a counselor sees this, a problem that they're really worried about, I think it's incumbent that there's contact with the family. And conversely, I think, you know, really the ultimate responsibility is with the family. And they need to, people, we all need to try to engage in the same behavior. Hey, I'm not criticizing you. I'm just, you know, worried what's going on with your grades, or, you know, how come you were out, you know, last night, or, you know, just what's going on. Mm-hmm. I think the kind of Columbo approach is what I call it. You know, hey, I was just wondering, I noticed this.
Just rather, one more question.
Yeah, exactly. Just one more question. Because yeah, most people, when they're suffering, are literally, you know, in pain and are often confused and often don't know what to do. And just the reach out is often enough to help get people headed in the right direction.
Sure. So I imagine, you know, the role for, you know, not only the parents but teachers or also employers and other leaders would be to not be afraid of addressing possible problems that might be mental health issues, or it could be something else too, but be open to helping identify, you know, a need for early intervention.
Yeah, you know, there's an abundant amount of research showing that the cost to the U.S. healthcare system for mental health care for employers is 1/37th the cost of untreated mental illness in their workforce. In other words, the so-called return on investment is 37-fold to one if you help your employees get help. Well, first of all, if you ideally create an employee a work environment in which stress is manageable. And there are a lot of ways in which businesses can be taught to mitigate unnecessary stress. And, you know, stress is one of those relative terms and is often poorly used. Some stress is normal in life. It's part of competition. It's part of how we all measure achievement. But stress in the form of uncontrollable conflicts is something that's very, very pernicious. And work in an environment in a workforce or a school in which there are outlets for stress, in which stressful situations are are prevented, mm-hmm. can go a long way towards just good mental health. But I think then it's just fundamental knowledge, and I think as a society we still are a little bit behind our general knowledge of health issues in general in the mental health area. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of smart people who suffer from depression who don't really know, gee, I have the signs and symptoms of depression. In 2008, when the economy started to derail, there were a handful of individuals that I saw for the first time. These were typically men in their 50s and 60s who were highly accomplished individuals, typically in the finance area, who had for the first time in their lives very serious first episodes of depression. And part of it was triggered by a sense of profound guilt that they had been stewards over substantial financial losses, not just for themselves but for their clients. So there was a sense of loss of control. It was also fueled by the 24-hour news cycle, where, you know, you can literally watch the markets around the world 24/7, and that was a situation in which people couldn't really do much about what those markets were doing, but we're just deluged with bad news over and over again. In fact, often the first intervention was quit watching the news, which sometimes helped. But a lot of these very bright people really didn't know that they had classic symptoms of depression. They ended up on my door after a primary care physician said, gee, you know, you've got sleep problems, appetite problems, energy problems. You better go see a psychiatrist. So I think as a kind of public health issue, information about the signs and symptoms of common psychiatric disorders is still something of a challenge for us.
Yeah, and I would imagine even, I know we're talking about failure to launch in the first place, but if you end up with a psychiatric disorder or something that impairs your functioning later on, you could oftentimes find yourself back at home.
Oh, yeah. And again, I think it's a good marker for double checking. There are all kinds of reasons why people may not be quote unquote successful in some given path of life. I always remind people of Ulysses S. Grant, who was a quote unquote failure at three or four businesses before he became a Civil War hero and then ultimately a president. I don't think he actually ever went back to live with his parents, though. But at times when things are not going right, it's often, there are plenty of reasons for things not to go right that have nothing to do with mental health problems. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when things are not going right and someone's ending up not being able to sustain the basic things that we try to sustain as adults, self-sufficiency, relationships, and a career path, mm-hmm. I think that's a good time to double check, hey, is there something else going on, something else that might be underlying this, particularly a mental health problem that, mm-hmm. that can be addressed and treatable. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the nice things about the field of psychiatry and mental health treatment overall in the last 25 years is that there have probably been more advances in this field of medicine than in any other field of medicine over a comparable time frame. And that's really just wonderful as a clinician, because you can really help people not just get a little bit better but limp along. Now the goal of treatment for most people with most common psychiatric problems is a full remission, full recovery of their recovery from that illness and going on with their lives.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I know some of the places that I know about here, they work on a recovery model, whether it be bipolar or schizoaffective disorder or whatever. It's about recovery and to have the fullest life you possibly can.
Exactly. People shouldn't be defined by their illness,
right.
No more than somebody with diabetes or heart disease is, nobody walks around and says, oh, you're a diabetic. No, you're so-and-so. This is what, who you are, father, wife, lawyer, business person, whatever, mm-hmm. And you happen to have diabetes. Well, the same thing should be true if you have depression and bipolar disorder. The goal is to manage those illnesses so that they can be put off to the side of one's life rather than, hitting you head on and ruining your life.
Sure. I understand that. And looking at the time real quick, Dr. Keck, we need to take a quick break, but we're going to be back with more. We're talking to Dr. Paul Keck, Jr. He is President and CEO of Linder Center of Hope, a premier mental health center in Cincinnati, Ohio. And we're talking about failure to launch and what's really holding back emerging adults. And we'll be back with more in just a moment with Answers for the Family.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back for more Answers for the Family. I'm your host today, Dr. Melody Fox, clinical psychologist, and my co-host, Alan Cardoza, is off on doing what he does best with his detective agency and also his teen transport company, doing what he does best today. We are talking today about failure to launch, what's really holding back emerging adults, and our guest today is Dr. Paul Keck, Jr. He is the president and CEO of Linder Center of Hope, and welcome back, Dr. Keck.
Thank you.
Well, I have a couple listener questions here, and I thought we could do those real quick before we get into a little bit more. One of them in particular caught my eye. It says, after I saw the title of the show and read the webpage, I had vivid flashbacks from the movie of the same title, Failure to Launch, starring Matthew McConaughey and Sarah Jessica Parker. The movie may be funny, but the topic is quite scary. Fellow teachers at our high school discuss frequently the continued decline in the maturity levels of our students, and these kids are unprepared to accept even minimal adult responsibility. We feel helpless in making any impact on changing this. What is your view on that?
That's not great to hear, but entirely understandable, and something I unfortunately see a lot too. I think there are a number of things that contribute to a kind of, let's call it, protracted adolescence or delay in the normal time course to people achieving independence. It's an unfortunate truism about psychiatry is for too many generations and too long in our history, we blame the family. And I don't want to fall into that trap. But I think part of the challenge that we all face as parents of adolescents and young adults is giving them support. And that means encouragement, but also the freedom to fail. There's an enormous pressure these days on achievement, you know, the sort of cynical views that, you know, where you get into the first preschool can determine whether or not you end up at an Ivy League school or not. You know, very, very sort of exaggerated senses of how quickly people need to achieve and a lot of pressure on young people that wasn't there before. I think it also tends to encourage a kind of, you know, the phrase, the helicopter parent, the hovering parent who swoops in and tries to do probably a little too much for kids sometimes. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of good data now showing that, you know, for example, where you go to college doesn't really matter so much as how you do in college. And how you do in college, in turn, depends more on having the freedom to follow your heart, to follow your true passions and interests. And I think just having that kind of view is probably a little healthier as we help kids along. I think the other thing is that a lot of, you know, our generation, my generation, the baby boomers, a college degree was considered just critical for life success. And I'm not saying it's not important, but there are a lot of important jobs and truly meaningful things that people do that have nothing to do with a college degree that I think, unfortunately, have been undervalued. So allowing a teenager and young adult to try to pursue something that really fits with their talents rather than fits with what we project as who they should be, in other words, living their dreams rather than our dreams, is a really delicate thing to do, but something I think we all need to remind ourselves from time to time. But I was saying support is important. Support is important, but also it's got to be, hey, you know, some clear expectations about what a young adult's responsibilities are. And I think the clearer those expectations, this gets back to the whole communication issue, I think then the better people do. I think this is true of all of us in our jobs. The more you know what your job is and what's expected of you, usually the more successful you are, the more ambiguous things are, the less the clear the goals are, sometimes the harder it is to get to those goals.
Oh, sure.
I think those are pretty essential things. But I think, and again, not to constantly circle back to mental illness, because it's not, you know, fortunately the majority of people don't have psychiatric illnesses, but because this is such a vulnerable age for the emergence of psychiatric problems, I think when somebody isn't launching, I think that's the time when you have to think, is there something else going on?
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, anxiety, depression, sleep disturbance, appetite disturbance, problems concentrating, drug and alcohol problems. This is the time when these things unfortunately blossom. And I think, you know, just being vigilant about any signs of those things and getting somebody help quickly is the key to making sure they don't wreak havoc for years and years and years down the road.
Yeah. And along with that, too, I keep thinking some of that could be what's going on with your child, but it could also have something to do with what's going on with the parents and their own need for that child not to launch.
Yeah, and there are, I don't pretend that this is a common issue, but I think it is. I've certainly seen it sometimes in families where marriage is struggling, you know, having a, especially the younger children in the brood, if you will, having someone still at home meets a need that's maybe not altogether healthy for one of the parents too.
Yeah, I just see that come up occasionally, and it's just interesting when the parent works through their reasoning why they're kind of holding back or manipulating the situation to keep their child at home, that finally the child could go on and launch and they could actually move on with their life as well. And I have another listener question here, and it kind of goes along the same thing. He says, I'm a 68-year-old senior. I have a daughter with what should be a grown son. He's 26. He's still living at home, dragging his heels about finishing college, 5 years in, and keeps changing degrees. I so hate to be negative, but my daughter and son-in-law demand so little of my grandson in return for still living off of them. He even gets an allowance as long as he stays in school. And I understand this is more common now than ever before. And as much as I love them all, I really feel it's very wrong to say or do anything. I wonder if there is anything with your recommendation or what your recommendation would be. Are there any resources, books, or whatever that I could introduce into the situation that would help?
Well, yeah, I'm always a little bit cautious about making, you know, recommendations about a specific situation without obviously knowing everything, but that the issue I think touches on some important generalities. One, I think, you know, most of the framework, it sounds like that family is set up, makes sense. On the other hand, it sounds like the proposition, if you will, is a little bit open-ended. Paying someone or giving someone an allowance and support for pursuit of academics indefinitely can lead to the perpetual student phenomena. And I think maybe part of that allowance is, okay, it runs out, you know, at X point in time by which it would be reasonable for you to have finished your studies. That's probably a good first start. Another might be to set up, and I've seen a lot of families successfully do this, set up what I call a taper schedule. You know, you have allowance X now, but in a year it's going to be X minus 50%, and a year after that it's going to be zero, so that you don't just pull the rug out from under someone, but you send the message that, hey, it's important for you, not because we're trying to be punitive or because we don't love you or because we're being critical of you, but it's important for you to make your life's way. And if we are enabling, in the, you know, the addiction language, if we are enabling behavior that isn't ultimately healthy by helping you towards a goal, then we're not doing you any favors.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, understanding what our motives are as parents and helping people have, you know, our kids, almost no matter what the age, but especially in that failure launch age, mm-hmm. Face forward and understand the need that they need to get there.
Right. Yeah, and I think giving them a time limit, setting things up ahead of time to know what to expect, gives them an opportunity to figure out, hey, what am I going to do next year? Or my parents want me to move out in 6 months, so I've got to start thinking about how am I going to pay for a room somewhere? What am I going to do? And gets them
right.
a little bit more motivated. But then again, if you've got a child that has some mental illnesses or they're having difficulty making decisions or following through on things because of that, and it's interfering, how what does somebody do to get diagnosed, and what would treatment look like, and how would it help them?
Well, I always say that as a psychiatrist, I really don't do much. I listen carefully to people and their problems and try to spend as much time with them as I can to understand the nature of their problems, and ideally include the family. And then, based on all of that information, try to render a diagnosis either in formal terms or frame a problem in a way that people can understand, and then embark on the best evidence-based treatment. Mm-hmm. Now that's a little bit disingenuous to say, because that's really the heart of what, you know, the history of medicine is all about. That's good medical care, and I say medical in the broadest sense here, not just, you know, MD defined. Unfortunately, you know, healthcare reimbursement in this country is not ideally set up. There isn't a great reward financially for healthcare professionals to spend as much time as often as needed to really thoroughly listen to and understand a person's problems, to spend the extra time to get the family involved, ideally at an appointment, at an initial visit, and then to, you know, thoughtfully deploy the best treatment recommendations they can. But that's really the essence. Mm-hmm. I've seen so many misadventures in treatment because the proper amount of time or information just didn't get spent or collected respectively up front, and either a misdiagnosis was made or a diagnosis was missed, a problem was missed, and then was left, you know, to fester for long, long periods of time. Mm-hmm. Getting a good assessment by a well-regarded mental health clinician is just that. It's a good consultation. And I always tell people, hey, you know, it's a free country. You can take or leave the recommendations as you want when you leave the office, but what can it hurt to go in and sit down, and if there's even the smallest doubt that there may be a problem, just go over and talk it over with someone. Maybe there isn't a problem, and if there isn't, great. Then you just got that much more assurance. On the other hand, if there is, most problems are readily addressable, and addressing those problems is often the catalyst for somebody not only launching but, you know, thriving mm-hmm. for the rest of their lives.
And that's ultimately what we want. But sometimes there are a lot of barriers, not only, you know, poor reimbursement or whatever, so you're less likely to want to spend the time because you want to see more clients or what have you, but also your hands are tied, like with, I think it's Medicaid out there or Medi-Cal or whatever, or Department of Mental Health, they have stipulations that you can only see them for so many sessions, you could only go this long, you could only do this much, you could only see them this often, you know, so you can't do as broad and as supportive work as you would like to do to help that person get up off their feet and move forward in life.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I think a lot of those constraints, are historic and go back to a period of time when, I'll call it the evidence base, you know, the well-recognized, proven treatments for a variety of mental health problems was a lot thinner. And so payers, for whatever reason, mostly cost containment, were unwilling to provide the kind of support and treatment that people need. And I'm all for responsible healthcare dispersal, but money spent well up front mm-hmm. For treatment of just about any medical problem, let alone a mental health problem, usually is paid off many, many fold down the road in terms of alleviation of human suffering, obviously, but also in regaining productivity and people contributing to our economic life force, not just in human happiness.
And also in their families. I mean, if your child is thriving, you're going to have a lot less worries as you're growing older on who's going to take care of them, because they've actually learned to take care of themselves.
Oh, you bet. I mean, these are illnesses that first and foremost affect not just the person with the problem, but the entire family.
Right.
And one of the things that we try to emphasize to employers as they think about their mental health care benefits for their employees is that, well, it's not so much, I mean, the impact is bad enough if you have a teenage son or daughter with a mental health problem. But that also means you usually have to take time off work if you're the employee. If there's a really serious problem and that person ends up in the hospital or something like that, then the absenteeism from your employees is going to really affect your overall business. So being smart about supporting access to care is a huge and smart business proposition.
Yeah, and being on the other side, I see a lot of people come in, and you know, some people have really excellent benefits, and it seems like their employers want them to have the mental health help as they need it because they're in very stressful jobs or what have you. But then I see other people that have very minimal, and then they don't really make enough to pay for the treatment that they really need, and it makes it very difficult for that. So I just see as employers start cutting back, that's one of the areas they cut back on.
Yeah, and I think, again, it's a fool's game to compare, adequacy of coverage across different healthcare problems. But I think what a lot of employers and I think our society in general fails to appreciate is that mental illness is the number one public health problem.
Mm-hmm.
In total, all mental health problems, including addictions, supersede the combined impact of cancer and heart disease and diabetes in our country. Mm-hmm. And moreover, those mental health problems often very, very insidiously interact with all these other medical problems. So if you have depression and heart disease, for example, and you don't treat the depression, the chance of someone dying of their heart disease is much greater.
Mm-hmm.
Same with breast cancer and all kinds of other problems. So that
sure.
When we start taking mental health issues out and isolating them or considering them in isolation, I think we're not considering the human being and the necessity of optimizing someone's health overall by addressing their mental health problems.
Absolutely. And Dr. Keck, as president and CEO of Linder Center of Hope and a treatment provider in the Midwest, what do you offer families that may be dealing with a family member who is suffering from any kind of mental illness or those that are just failing to launch?
Well, the Center of Hope is one of North America's newest comprehensive purely mental health facilities, and we've been very, very blessed to have had the support of a local family, the Linder family, in creating this center. Locally, we provide, and locally I mean in the greater Cincinnati area and in the Midwest in general, comprehensive mental health services, outpatient, inpatient care.
Mm-hmm.
We have a research institute and a lot of state-of-the-art treatment services. As a national resource, we also have something called the Sibsey House, which is a private pay residential unit that was specifically designed to help people who have complex illnesses beginning at age 18 and over. And in fact, I'd say the average person who comes to the Sibsey House, and we have people come from all over the country and indeed all over the world, come because of these failure to launch issues. The Sibsey House has a very specific 10-day or 28-day treatment program designed first and foremost to accurately diagnose people and create very individualized treatment plans. We often work hand in hand with a lot of other programs around the country, a group that we call the Network of Hope, in helping people get follow-up care if they don't live in our area. And in fact, the ideal care for any kind of psychiatric problem is really in one's neighborhood. So People come here to kind of get it figured out and get started on a on the best treatment possible, but then we often hand off treatment to the best providers and teams in their own neighborhoods. And we see a lot of people who have just been recently stabilized after experiencing, say, their very first behavioral health crisis. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of people who have been struggling with long-standing mental health problems, and people can't quite figure out what the problem is or why they're not getting better. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of experience in intermittent or escalating behavioral crises, and we actually work with Alan in helping younger people as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like your organization is doing a lot of wonderful things, and I particularly care for that you do the research, because not enough research is being done, I don't think.
Well, I agree. In fact, there's been a well-cited statistic that new scientific discoveries often take many, many years before their actual adoption into clinical care, which is a real problem. Mm-hmm. One of the nice things about having a research institute under the same roof is that we can take new findings, new treatments, right from brand new research studies and weave them into someone's care in a true state-of-the-art fashion, and often in a way that allows people to access treatment that they otherwise probably wouldn't even hear about for years.
Sure.
And that's made a real difference.
And I hate to cut you off, but we're actually out of time. So somebody might be interested in treatment or contacting you or the center. How would they do that?
The best number to call is 513-536-HOPE. That's our general number.
Mm-hmm.
And for the SIPSE House, it's 513-536-4673.
And a website?
Website is www.LindnerCenterOfHope.org. That's LINDNER, CenterOfHope.org.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Keck. I know you're very busy. We do appreciate all your knowledge and you spending time with us today on Answers for the Family. And much success to you. And I look forward to reading some of your material and your outcomes of all the research you're doing.
Well, and thank you. And thanks for your kindness in having me on today. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you very much. And everybody will be back for more Answers of the Family, the same time, same place, next week. Take care and bye for now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.